as I said at the outset, the third case, because of the illness of one attorney, this case will be taken under advisement and be taken on the briefs. Therefore, we'll move to the fourth case scheduled for this morning, which is Brenda Larimore versus Ritchie Realty. Gary.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kristen Carey and I represent the appellant, Mrs. Brenda Larimore. The issue before the court today is whether the Equal Credit Opportunity Act protects a person like Mrs. Larimore from being denied an opportunity to have suitable housing solely because she is required to use a Section 8 voucher in order to pay for her apartment. The ECOA prohibits a creditor from discriminating against an applicant with respect to any aspect of the credit transaction based upon several factors, one of which is whether the applicant's source of income is from public assistance program. In this case, the district court granted defendant Ritchie Realty Management Company's motion to dismiss, finding that a residential lease was not a credit transaction under the ECOA. Today, we ask that this court reverse the district court's finding. Whether the act of entering into a residential lease equates to a credit transaction turns on whether the lease provides for a deferred payment of debt. The district court reasoned that it did not provide for a deferred payment of debt because rental payments are typically paid at the first of each month, and therefore payment is applied for that month. The district court equated these monthly rental payments as prepaid advancements of debt for contemporaneous use. The district court's reasoning fails to take into account the fact that a residential tenant's obligations do not extinguish at the end of each month. A tenant who signs a year-long lease is obligated to pay rent for the entire year, and furthermore, the tenant then has the right to maintain possession of that particular property for the entire year.
Do you make any distinction between real property and personal property on these types of things, this type of credit?
In this specific situation, Your Honor, it deals with real property. There is case law that holds that certain personal property leases are also credit transactions under the ECOA. The only distinguish that you need to make is whether or not the lease provides for a deferred payment of debt, regardless of whether we're purchasing property, services, or a place to live for a year.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you say there are cases that deal with personal property, and that seems to be a little bit of a blurry area. But clearly, this is an occupancy, and it is contemporaneous. You pay monthly, although there's a year's lease. But it does seem that this is a fairly unique. It's certainly different than the Ninth Circuit case that you rely on substantially.
It is, Your Honor, and the argument that we would like to propose is that in this situation, it's not payment for contemporaneous use. In fact, and the basis for that is because, especially under Illinois landlord-tenant law, is that once a tenant takes possession of an apartment, say pursuant to a year-long lease, that particular tenant has the right to occupy that apartment for the entire year. Even if the tenant does not pay his or her rent, the landlord cannot terminate the lease. The landlord has to go through a series of actions in order to terminate that tenant's right to maintain possession of that property. So in a situation such as that, I think that's more akin to a deferred payment of debt as opposed to, say, a month-to-month or a month-by-month lease or a month-to-month tenancy where, yes, in that situation, the tenant's paying for that month's use. But when you have a year-long lease or a long-term lease, that situation is more akin to a deferred payment of debt.
Well, that's just kind of a security thing on each end. As you just described, it's hard to throw somebody out of an apartment when they're not paying their rent, which is the risk the landlord takes. He has to go through all these procedures. On the other hand, The tenant can't be thrown out if somebody comes and offers more money. So you have the tenant has some security there, but it is month-to-month use and month-to-month payment. And if, of course, if it extends, oftentimes it is month-to-month. And then it just, I guess you wouldn't say that's a loan then.
Well, the distinction that the appellant is trying to make in this situation is that it's not a month-to-month rent. If a tenant enters into a year-long lease, again, that obligation is for the entire year. Regardless of whether the tenant is able to pay the rent or not pay the rent, the payment is deferred over that entire period of time.
You know, I think you make a good argument, policy reasons why perhaps this definition of credit should extend to one of these leases, but the agency that interprets these things, I don't know, it's the Federal Reserve Board or something like that, they're in more day-to-day contact with these things, and their interpretation of it is consistent with the realty companies here, that it's not covered. So why should we not give deference to that interpretation?
Certainly. The only interpretation that the board provides was in a supplementary information which was tacked on to an official commentary. Over the time period that has passed, that supplementary information was never incorporated into either the regulations or any of the official staff commentaries of the Federal Reserve Board. Certainly wasn't put into the actual statute itself. In 1986, when the staff commentaries were again revised, there is a provision that indicates that anything, any interpretation by the Federal Board which has not been included in the staff commentary or in the regulation has thus been superseded. Recent revisions in 2004, again, no commentaries with respect to this particular issue of whether residential leases are covered under the ECOA.
What was the year that the Ninth Circuit decision was announced to Judge Mannion?
The Ninth Circuit decision was 1984.
So it was before. So when these revisions were made by the board, that Ninth Circuit decision was available.
Correct. The Ninth Circuit decision was in 84. The information came out in 85, and subsequent revisions have not incorporated the supplemental information, which I believe the court is referring to, commenting on the Brothers decision. That's never been brought in as part of the regulation. It's never been brought in as part of the official staff commentary.
Well, the Brothers decision, really, in extending this, it's the only way I can describe it, refers to the CLA? What is that? What's that acronym for? CLA.
Consumer Leasing Act.
Yeah. They refer to that, and even there in its footnote, it cites that the form of a lease or a bailment for the use of personal property. And I just wondered if that is confined to personal property, the CLA, because they relied on the CLA because that's the only one that's specified, and the ECOA does not. The Ninth Circuit, as emphasized by the dissent in that case, kind of stretched it out just sort of on a philosophical thing, say, well, you know, we really shouldn't have discrimination, and Congress just probably either forgot or left it out, or, you know, they just basically added it in.
The difference between in that situation is the Consumer Leasing Act talks specifically about consumer leasing. The ECOA's definition of credit transaction and credit is much broader than the CLA's definition. Credit transaction is any deferred payment of debt under the ECOA. The Ninth Circuit based its ruling on pulling the language of the CLA and TILA into applying the ECOA. In this situation, I don't think we need to make that argument. The definition in the ECOA is broad enough to encompass residential leases.
Well, at least that's the way they thought it was broad enough to, but thought it also was. I'm not really sure how, when I read that case, it just seems that Judge Reinhardt just thought it was a good idea.
We agree with Judge Reinhardt. As a matter
of... No, you do. But, I mean, that's maybe a lot of people do, but it's just a question whether Congress bothered to agree with him.
There's no legislative history, as far as the ECOA is concerned, discussing the specific issue of residential leases. Again, the ECOA's definition isn't certainly broad enough to cover residential leases, and as a matter of policy, I think it is a very good idea to cover residential leases under the ECOA. There's certainly case law in it that supports the idea that residential leases should be covered under the ECOA. We respectfully request that this court review the district court's finding and, first of all, it's find as a matter of law that the ECOA does, in fact, cover residential leases as credit transactions. I see that my time is up. And
are there any other independent, you know, other than this Credit Act, any other laws that regulate refusing to rent to somebody who's getting a government voucher to pay for part of their housing? Are there any fair housing acts or anything like that that would cover this situation?
There certainly are, and I think it's very important to note that if the ECOA is found to cover residential leases, that only helps tenants and plaintiffs in Fair Housing Act cases to use the ECOA, because the ECOA would then require a landlord or management company to disclose the purpose of why they are rejecting the application, whether it be for creditworthiness, et cetera. They
can Evans is asking, though, whether it's under federal housing or whatever, is there a law specifically dealing with those as opposed to this? When you say, well, if we apply the ECOA, then... But is there another law? Obviously not, if you didn't raise it, I guess.
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know that the FHA does prohibit discrimination, specifically as to Section 8 vouchers. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer to that question.
It's not like an owner. You know, running your upstairs, that's a different thing. But if you own an apartment building that has 50 units or something, and the rent is $500 a month, and you get $250 a month in a voucher from the government, there's got to be some law that would prohibit that owner from not accepting $500 from that person if $250 is coming from the government. Isn't there any laws that... I haven't looked at this, but I can't imagine that there isn't.
Yeah, I apologize also, but that issue wasn't briefed, and I'm not aware of any. My sense is that the FHA definitely prohibits discrimination based upon financial assistance. I'm not exactly sure if that includes public assistance as far as a Section 8 voucher.
Well, but here, not to prolong this when your light is on, but here it seems pretty clear, at least from the record that's before us, that that's the sole reason for rejecting this person as a tenant.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, if we look at the case law where the courts have found that a lease is not a credit transaction under the ECOA, even those courts indicate that we should take a look at the language of the lease and find out what the relationship is between the leasee and the lessor. And in this situation, Mrs. Larimore never got that opportunity. She was told flat out, because she has a Section 8 voucher, we're not going to rent this apartment to you. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Hoey.
May it please the court, counsel. Judge Evans, if there is another statute that applies in this circumstance, it's a statute that hasn't been invoked in this case, and the plaintiff hasn't raised any other statutory basis for bringing...
I think he was searching for whether or not there was another avenue of relief that would be available. Or is this the only avenue of relief available to somebody who was rejected because they have an 8 voucher?
I can only presume that this is the only avenue that's available, because it's the only avenue that the plaintiff has invoked in this case. And I presume that if there were some other statute that applied, it would have been pleaded as an alternative ground. It's also important to recognize at this stage of the of the case, and I just want to stress something I'm sure the court is already aware of. At this stage of the pleadings, there is still a great dispute as to whether the actions that are alleged in the complaint even occurred. It is in dispute as to whether Mrs. Larimore was even denied housing in the first place. Of course, at this stage, we are presuming that those allegations are true, but I do hope the court will remember that that is not a given at this stage. Assuming that they are true, however, and that Mrs. Larimore was denied housing and that the basis for that denial was her receipt of public assistance, that set of facts simply is not covered by the Equal Credit Opportunity Act because it is not a credit transaction. There is no dispute between the parties that whether it's a credit transaction or not is defined by the idea of whether or not there is the right to defer payment. And the plaintiff's argument is critically premised upon the mistaken notion that at the time a tenant signs a lease, he or she becomes obligated at that time for the entire amount of the lease, of the rent payment to be paid over the period of the lease. That is to say, if a lease is signed on January 1st for the coming year, under the plaintiff's argument, the tenant already owes the rent for December. That is simply not the way the typical residential lease works. It's certainly not the way that this court can presume any lease works. The way a lease works in a residential situation is the way the district court interpreted it here, and that is that each month or each period under the lease, the tenant becomes obligated to pay that amount. And that amount is due and payable at the time that that period begins. It's a contemporaneous exchange of payment for the right to occupy the unit for that period of time. Nothing about that arrangement or that agreement changes if the plaintiff, if the tenant chooses to leave the premises before the term of the lease is up. It doesn't advance the plaintiff's argument to point out that the obligation continues over the course of time. It might be different. If there were some agreement by which the plaintiff agreed on the way out the door to pay the remaining term of the lease, but that again would presume that the plaintiff, that the tenant, was becoming liable for that for future amounts of rent at the time of either the signing of the lease or the departure from the premises. Say, for example, a year-long lease, January to December, that the tenant chooses to leave in July. The tenant still remains on the hook for rent on a monthly basis. Doesn't become obligated in July for December's rent just because she leaves the premises at that time. That is the way that all of the cases that have interpreted this, all the published decisions, have interpreted residential leases and leases in general.
Well, I guess, are you saying that there may be some duty to mitigate, or obviously if the landlord rents it out to someone else, then the tenant's obligation abates or all that. But what if they don't? I assume if you can't get somebody else to rent the apartment, then those obligations would continue to accrue, I guess.
Exactly. And that's the perfect way of putting it. They do continue to accrue on a monthly basis or whatever period of time the lease is agreed to be paid on. And that's what I mean when I say that the tenant who moves out in July isn't then liable for December's rent. She remains liable for July's rent, for August's rent, and so on and so forth for the term of the lease, but still on a monthly basis. There is no authority to suggest that at the time the tenant departs the premises, he or she becomes liable for future for rent for future months that he or she is not going to be using the premises. And the notion of mitigating damages is a critical one as well because, oddly enough, of a Southern District of Ohio case, the Liberty Leasing case that's been cited in the briefs, that case held that a leasing agreement did not qualify as a credit transaction because it did not involve future payment of rent or a deferment of payments for rent. And the plaintiff has attempted to distinguish that case by pointing to the fact that there was a right to mitigate under that contract. Well, that doesn't distinguish this case at all from our current circumstances, because in Illinois, there is not only a right to mitigate one's damages, there's a duty to mitigate. And if the right to mitigate damages, the right to go out and find someone else to pay for rent through July through December, is a distinguishing factor.
A tenant's right or a landlord's right?
That is a landlord's right.
Well, I mean, it's a right to mitigate. It's either a duty to mitigate it, or a tenant might have a right to get someone else in there and sublease.
So does a landlord.
That's correct.
Landlord's got the duty.
That's correct. In Illinois, the landlord has the duty to mitigate damages by finding another party. And what that landlord is doing in that circumstance is not going out and finding a third party to pay a debt that the defaulting tenant owes, because it's not a debt. They're going out and finding someone else to incur the monthly obligation. That is what the mitigation duty involves. And that only further proves that...
The tenant has no obligation to go out and seek out somebody to fill in the place. He can sit quietly by and force the landlord to go out and mitigate damages himself, if I recall correctly.
That's correct. And if the plaintiff maintains that Liberty Leasing is a correct case because of the right to mitigate in that case, then certainly in this case the district court was correct because of the duty that one has to mitigate, that a landlord has to mitigate damages in Illinois. With respect briefly to the notion of the supplemental information and whether that should be given any consideration in this case, it's important to recognize that what the board has done in the years since that supplemental information was issued has never done anything to contradict what it said in that commentary. That commentary stated very explicitly and expressly that the Brothers case was wrong, that the Ninth Circuit got it wrong. The plaintiff maintains in a number of different ways that you can't take that statement as being authoritative, largely in the briefs, because, as she says, that the board did not object to enforcing that decision. It's hard to know what else the board might have done when confronted with a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision other than to enforce it. To suggest that the only way the board could have effectively expressed its disagreement with the Ninth Circuit was to defy it is a fairly bold argument, a mighty bold argument to be making, I should say, in another federal court of appeals. The fact that the statements in the supplementary information have never made their way into a subsequent regulation also does not render them unimportant because, again, they have not been contradicted. There has never been any suggestion that the board has changed its mind or had a change of heart. The board had a very specific reason for finding that Brothers interpreted the ECOA too broadly to include lease transactions, and that was the fact that Congress has treated those decisions, those concepts differently. It did so, in fact, as the dissenting judge in Brothers recognized, when it amended the ECOA and when it amended other related statutes. With respect to the passage of the ECOA in 1974 and its subsequent amendment 2 years later, Congress never suggested that it had any intention of extending the purview of that statute to lease transactions. And it had lease transactions on its mind because it was amending other portions of the Consumer Credit Protection Act at the very same time. The Truth in Lending Act is a good example. Congress didn't just ignore or forget about or not realize that it needed to address something it wanted to address. It had lease transactions on the mind and very well could have and should have added those provisions to the ECOA if that had been its intent. The fact that it did not is not an inadvertent omission. It's a significant omission and a telling one in interpreting what Congress had in mind with respect to the ECOA.
Well, it seems in the Ninth Circuit, in its opinion, it referred to beforehand, it said the ECOE did not at least initially apply to consumer leases. But then when the CLA came along, they kind of incorporated that concept. That's where the Ninth Circuit did. So it seemed to be even dependent then on that external statute as overlaying on this one.
That's correct. And that specifically seems to be the basis for the Ninth Circuit majority decision in Brothers. It held that the amendment to the CLA for lack of a better word, sort of bled over into the ECOA. But the CLA is not part of the ECOA. They are distinct titles of an umbrella statute, the Consumer Credit Protection Act.
Your time's up, so put a wrap on it.
Certainly, Your Honor. The suggestion that that Congress might simply have overlooked the need to address this is simply not a correct one. The Brothers' decision seems to be driven by an idea that this was a noble statute, and well, it may be, but it is Congress's role and the role of the Federal Reserve Board to extend it to areas other than those that are in the statute, and we would respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the district court.
Okay, thanks. Is there any time left over here? Okay. That completes the argument on that case, then. The case will be taken under advisement. Thanks to both counsel.